Okay. Oops, I need my... What did, oh, my new glasses are on my head. Did you guys see my new glasses? Very nice. Aren't they cute? Okay. Now we're going to talk about fear. And down at the bottom of page 67, it says, notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classified with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. So now it says, first action with the fear inventory. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. What we're going to do is we're going to set the fears down, just like we did the resentments. List the fears. Fear of flying. Fear of being rejected. Fear of failure. Whatever the fear is, set it down on paper. Then we go, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. Even though we had no resentment in connection with them, we ask ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? So what I do with the women I sponsor is it's like three columns. And I put the first column down with the fears. Why am I afraid? And then the last column, then we're going to break it down into some more columns in other words, we're going to peel the onion away from the fears. Let's just keep reading a little bit. Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Let's use an example. I'm afraid one that I have, what I had a terrible, terrible fear of, and I love what Clancy says. Clancy says that we're people who have to be treated special just to feel average. And if you don't treat us special, then we feel rejected. I'm a person who's always needed you to treat me better than most people. In other words, if you just treated me average, I would feel rejected. But somehow my own self-worth is so low that I am counting on you to build me up. That's what I need. And I am afraid of rejection. So I put down here, fear of rejection. Why am I afraid of being rejected? Because then I have to write, why am I afraid of being rejected? So I'm afraid of being rejected because I may be alone. And then I have to, well, what happens then? What happens if I'm alone? Then I won't have anybody to take care of me. Then if I don't have anybody to take care of me, what will happen? Well, if I don't have anybody to take care of me, I might die. But then if I die, what am I afraid of? Maybe I'm afraid that there's just no God. So what we do is we keep peeling the onion on the fear and keep breaking it down till I come to what is it that I'm really afraid of. Now I'm going to tell you about a fear that I had that I started the ball rolling, and that fear ran me into a terrible bout of illness. And this happened just a few years ago, and Bob was involved in it, so I'm going to tell you about it. My husband and I have a house, and we're on a very fixed income, and we have a trailer next door. And we had rented the trailer, and the people in the trailer had done some huge damage to it, and we had to do a lot of work on the trailer. It cost a lot of money. Now we need to get this trailer rented. So we have it up for rent. We have it up for rent. It doesn't rent, and it doesn't rent. And I'm getting scareder and scareder and scareder. And what happened is my fear of financial insecurity is what started the ball rolling. And what happened as a result of that is I got afraid of financial insecurity. And then if we don't get the house rented, what's going to happen? Well, maybe we'll lose, you know, we'll lose the property. I mean, then what'll happen then? Well, I'll starve. Then I'll be on, you know, on, well, homeless and yada, 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 on and on and on. But what really is I'm relying on self, because what I have forgotten is that God's in charge of renting that trailer. And somehow I think I am. And I'm constantly saying to my husband, did you do this? Did you do that? Did you do this? Did you put it on Craigslist? Did you do this? Did you do that? And Dave, laid back kind of guy, just sort of just, you know, just kind of eases all around in life, my rock. And he says, Polly, it'll be fine. God's going to take care of us. Oh, but. And the next thing I don't know, it starts off really subtly. And I'm not sleeping a little bit. And then pretty soon, before it's all over with, it's a lot about what Bob was talking about. I go 3 weeks, and if any of you have any kind of sleep problems, without sleeping, and I am insane by now. I am sick physically. I am insane. The only answer any Western medicine has for me is to throw pills at me. And I don't know about any of you, but if you've ever tried to take pills because you can't sleep, it don't work on us. And all it did is I did this for about a few days, and I had so much anxiety from the pills that now I can't sleep from that. And I'm going on, and I mean, it's just the ball is just, the ball's in motion, okay? And the fear is growing greater and greater. And by the time it's all over with, I end up with a physical condition. They found out I had low thyroid. Well, that's like a little tiny part of it. But what really happened was, is I finally got on my knees and I said, I'll do anything. I know I'm afraid. And I started writing this fear out. And I'd been doing it, but I wasn't being honest. And I've got to be honest with myself, because what I was doing is I wasn't looking at the fact that self-reliance had failed me. I really didn't see how I had made, how I was taking charge and not allowing God to be in charge. And what I said was, I'll do anything. And like we were talking about these God thoughts, the thought came to me, these Western doctors are not going to help me. What I need to do is I need to find an acupuncturist to help me. And what I did is I said, I just opened up the phone book, and I said, I'm going to call these acupuncturists. And the person who can see me today, because I'm going to die, I feel like, any moment, who can see me today is my new acupuncturist. And my husband was already beside himself. Because, I mean, you don't watch somebody go through this, and I'm like a wreck. And I go see this lady, and, you know, she just said, what are you afraid of? She's not throwing a pill at me. And finally, I end up taking a fifth step with an acupuncturist. Because I finally get to the fear. And I thought I'd already rode this horse. You know, I told you about the bankruptcy and all that. I thought I'd already rode that horse. I got an AA sponsor. She's just incredible. She has this term that'll just make your spine crawl. And she calls it repeat for correction. And I knew that I was in the middle of repeat for correction, because one more time I failed to trust God that he was going, God is my employer. God is the source of my income, not me. And one more time, I had this thing about fear. Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Okay, I've had some fears. I've been a fear, like I'm going into a job, and I'm afraid of the interview. And what happens is, to overcompensate for my fear, I can be cocky and arrogant. And I went into an interview one time, and I was so cocky and I was so arrogant because I was so afraid that I didn't get the job. If I'd have just gone in there and said, I really don't have good computer skills. I really need a lot of help in that area, but I'm really willing to learn. I would have been so much better off than if I had gone and acted like I knew something I didn't know. Because what happened was that came through. That fear of not being accepted, that fear of rejection, that I have to act like I'm something I'm not. One of the things that I have a really fear of, and I was sharing with someone earlier, was that I always felt like I know things. I know what you think I ought to be. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to behave and act like I think you ought to be, that you want me to be, because I am so afraid of being rejected. And I've got a lot of other fears. I mean, there's fears. Sometimes I hear in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, fear and faith can't live in the same place. And I don't believe that. I don't believe that at all. I believe what's marvelous is, and I'm going to read that in the next paragraph, I believe that I can have fear and that faith will help me walk through the fear. One of the things is that I may look like, when I come up here to talk behind a podium, that I'm not afraid. But I'm here to tell you, I'm the person who couldn't even stand in front of a class and give a book report. That's who I am. I am a person who, when I got married at 18 years old, and I was an Air Force officer's wife, and somebody told me some expectation they had of me, and I immediately got afraid and said I couldn't do that, that I backed off into a corner. And what I did is I took a few drinks of alcohol, and that alcohol allowed me the ability to just nod in the right places and laugh in the right places. But what happened is I didn't try to communicate in any way because I was uneducated. And see, if I was uneducated and then I started talking to you, you're going to find out how uneducated I am, and I'm going to feel worse. Because I'm 18 years old, and I'm with these people who I know are educated and sophisticated, and man, I don't even know what side of the plate the fork goes on. That's, you know, I have these feelings of inadequacy. But what happens is I know today, and I did everything I could to crawl away from that. To crawl away from ever being in front of anybody so you take any notice of me. So now in Alcoholics Anonymous, I come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got sober in Texas, which is a lot like if you get sober in Southern California. They have you speaking quick. A lot of speaker meetings, and they have podium participation meetings. You have to come to the podium and you have to speak. And this is what you do. This is how you do AA. And I'm terrified of doing that. But what happens is the faith helps me do what I'm afraid of. So that doesn't mean that I don't have the fear. There are people in this program that are terrified of flying. But yet AA calls them to do something. We have a friend who's not even afraid of flying. He saw his whole family die in a plane crash that he was in too. And he's the only survivor of that plane crash. Yet because of Alcoholics Anonymous, he's asked to get on an airplane and go places. Now, how do you suppose a person like that does that? They say a prayer, and they have faith that God's going to get them to the next destination, even though they're still afraid. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. I didn't ask to whatever it is, somewhere along the line that somehow I ended up with a gift for gab, I guess. So, I mean, it's no big, that's just it. It's like if you got a gift for music, you use your gift, whatever the gift is. And obviously somebody thought I had a gift for gab. And the next thing I know, I'm being asked to go speak places. Okay, I've come a long way because I still have on long sleeves, but I have long sleeves on now for different reasons. I used to wear long sleeves because I got so afraid when I got at this podium, I broke out in a rash. And the rash was all over my arms and everything. Now my arms are old and wrinkly, and I put the long sleeves on them to hide that. But so that's what happens, but you do it anyway. And still, when I come up to speak at a podium all day, I'm like, I always feel less than. Like, those people out there know more than I do. What am I doing up here? But it's not about what I know or you know. What it's about is for me to come up here and share my experience, strength, and hope. It's not about me being a star. It's not about me being up here to impress you. The deal is to do what I'm asked to do, whether I'm afraid or not, and ask God to use me and stop trying to have self-reliance, because it never works anyway. It never works. And I'm going to tell a little story. I told Sylvia this morning, I said, I don't know, altitude, whatever it is, most of it is that I've just had sleep problems all my life. I look at the clock, it's 1. I look at the clock, it's 3. I look at the clock, it's 4. And, you know, I don't sleep. And I say, oh, my God, you know, what's going to happen today is you get that and you think, oh, I can't think. I'm not going to be able to concentrate. I'm not going to even know what I read and all that. And you know what? It doesn't make any difference. I'm going to stand up and I'm going to say what God wants me to say anyway. And I won't even remember what I say when I sit down. Because most of the time, Bob and I were talking about it. I said, oh, well, you and Scott have done that a whole lot of times together because I'm feeling inadequate with Bob. And he says, we don't know what we're going to do. Every time it's different. Why? Because you ask God to help you. But see, the fear is going to, at the moment, has me having self-reliance. Just to the extent we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. And the only thing I can say is just for that sentence, because that's very visual to me. Calamity and serenity is so visual because fear lives in me. I can physically feel it. I don't know if you can, but you know, it's kind of a tightness in my stomach, and it's a pulls on my chest, and it kind of throbs in my temples, and I can feel that fear, and I'm really afraid. But then I ask God to help me, just like we humbly rely on Him. And to me, that's, I'm asking Him to help me, and I get up, and it just happens. It's not anything that I do. What I did, the actions that I take and the actions that I do, is I show up. I just show up. And I do what I've been told to do since the day I got sober, which is stay in this book. Stay in this book. I got sober in Texas where they pushed the book. Stay in the book. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. God does it. I don't have the education. I don't have the know-how. I don't have it. I just simply don't have it. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. I am weak. I am weak. I can promise you, I'm scared to death. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust God. And I'll tell you this, if I weren't afraid, I wouldn't need courage. Men of faith have courage. I do not believe, I don't care what anybody says, and I was married to a military man. I don't care what anybody says, you don't walk into war. I don't care how tough you think you are and not be afraid. And that's what my husband told me. You just do it anyway, even though you're terrified. You just do it anyway. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. I have said this prayer today probably about 5 times already today. That's a prayer I say all the time. I ask Him to remove my fear and direct my attention to what He would have me do. Because I can tell you, I don't know what God wants me to do. That's why when we get over to the 11th step, when we ask God to direct our thinking and our actions, what I need to do is ask God. And then we get that feeling that Bob talked about and that I talked about. And I tell you, I really believe when they talk about in the book that God lives within, that's where I feel it. When I feel like I need to do something, that's where I feel it. Okay. Oh, and one of the other things that I wanted to say before I started this to kind of go along with what Bob said about the resentments in the inventory. I am a person who it was done with me and it's what I do, but I take people through the steps really quickly. And I have people come up to my house often and ask me to take them through the steps. Even though I don't sponsor them, they may ask me to take them through the steps, maybe because I live closer and their sponsor is somewhere else. But I take people through the steps in a weekend. And that's for people sometimes I don't sponsor. The women I do sponsor, I'm on them really fast. Maybe since they live in town, maybe we'll take a week or two. But when we've done step 3, it's on to step 4. And I totally believe in, you don't need to write your autobiography. You can get this done by making some bullet points. And what I try to also say is, look at the pattern. You know, look at the pattern. Because a lot of times, it's like Shakespeare said, the stage remains the same, only the faces change. It's all the same stuff. You know, same day, different person. Or same whatever, however that goes. But the thing about it is we repeat that over and over and over. And I just got a call on my this morning that a lady whose sponsor lives somewhere else, and she lives in Bellevue, where they say I'm from, has asked me if I do a fifth step with her. And I do this often. And what I do when I do the steps is I sit somebody down, and through a weekend, we may do the whole thing. And if I'm taking somebody through a fifth step that I don't have staying at my house for a weekend, we do 4 through 8 in one sitting. All in one sitting. And and I'll tell you why I do it this way. I will read you. I'm in the, sorry, you can tell me what the fourth edition is. He sold himself short. What page is that? It's Earl Treat's story, and he sold himself short. The people I had been affiliated with in Texas were kind of descendants of Dr. Bob, and there's a lot of us, I think, running around.
258.
258 if you're in the fourth edition, and it's 291 if you're in the third.
Starts at 258.
258. Okay, but you're going to go over a few pages. 258, 259, about 260, one or two. It starts the day before I was due back to go to Chicago. A Wednesday in Dr. Bob's afternoon off. He had me down to his office and we spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the 6-step program as it was at that time. The steps were complete deflation, dependence and guidance from a higher power, moral inventory, confession, restitution, continued work with other alcoholics. Can you see how Bill enlarged those steps? Dr. Bob led me through all these steps. At the moral inventory, he brought some of my bad personality traits or character defects, such as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentment. We went over these at great length, and then he finally asked me if I wanted these defects of character removed. When I said yes, we both knelt at his desk and prayed, each of us asking to have these defects taken away. This picture is still vivid. If I live to be 100, it will always stand out in my mind. It was very impressive, and I wish that every AA could have had the benefit of this type of sponsorship. There's that word, sponsorship. A lot of people say, well, I don't see sponsorship in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Have that kind of sponsorship today. And needless to say, I can't do it in 3 or 4 hours. I've never been able to do that. But I can do it in a weekend. Take somebody through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that requires a lot of willingness on their part. But that's what was done for me, and I do it for others. Okay, now. Let's go. Now about sex. Okay, now on this inventory, on the sex inventory, it's also going to be different from the resentment inventory. Because now this inventory is not about people who've hurt me. It's about who I've hurt, about the people I've hurt. So what happens is a lot of times I'll work with women, and I know that this is just not women because I know my husband has had some sexual abuse in his background. But when I'm working with women, I would say that I am in the way minority of women who have not experienced sexual abuse as a child. Most of the women that I work with have had some pretty horrific sexual abuse. That inventory is on the resentment inventory. But as I'm here to tell you, I believe this with all my heart, that anybody who has been abused as a child, that a child is a victim. And when it gets over to the column where the fourth column is, and this is my opinion, when it gets over to the fourth column and it talks about my mistakes, if I am sitting at 30 years or however old I am, an adult anyway, and I am still living in that abuse and have not taken the steps in order to rid myself of the things that are blocking me from God, which it would be this abuse, then that's my mistake. And there are many people who sit in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not get to that process because there's no way until I can see that my mistake is not getting help, because I've got to find a way. I don't care how brutal it is or how horrific that's been. I have got to find a way to forgive that perpetrator. And if I don't forgive that perpetrator, I forever remain a victim. So that's going to take me to the... And a lot of times what happens is I'll see women do much like just what Bob was talking about when this man who had his father who beat him. Same thing. Same thing from that kind of abuse. To go and find out how I had been or they had been a terrible daughter. Or a terrible, well, for me, daughter. Because I'm working with women. And I have a sponsee, and I'm gonna tell you her story. And I think her story is every bit as commendable as the story Bob told about his sponsee and the father who abused him. I have this woman I sponsor, and she allows me to tell this story. And to the women I sponsor who need her help, because the sexual abuse is not my experience. It's not my experience. So a lot of times I want to get them with people who it is their experience, to share their experience, strength, and hope. So what happens is that she was incested by her father from the age of 8 to 15. That's a lot of years. And that was a huge, huge abuse. And she worked long and hard. Inventory after inventory after inventory. But she was tenacious because she wanted to recover and no longer be a victim. And I will say she also got some outside help. And she was able to reach a place where she could take a look at her father. And he had grown up in an orphanage. His parents, first of all, had divorced. Then his mother had four boys. And what happened was, is she kept three of the boys and put him in an orphanage. And she had to first go see, before she could really look at her inventory and how bad her child was, she had to look and see how bad her father's childhood was. And when she did, she saw how he had been rejected, how he had been abused, and found out about his abuse. And the thing that happens, and Al-Anon uses this term all the time, and this can happen to us if we don't get help, and that is that hurt people hurt people. And most of the time, someone who has been abused will end up being an abuser. A victim becomes an offender. And I need to not get into that role. I don't want to be an offender. I don't want that. I don't want to be that person. Although I was the person who did the abuse to my sons. So I was the offender. But what happened is she reached a place, like Bob was talking about, where she had forgiveness and she grew to love her father. But also, she was a responsible parent, and she had two children of her own, and she never, ever left her children at her father's house unless she was there. She never did deny his sickness. She just loved him even though he was sick and forgave him. And I'm grateful for that, because that's what my sons have done for me. That's what they've done for me. Many of us, now about sex again. I'm digressive. He was talking about ADD, somebody walking around. That's me. I'll get off on a subject and go from here to there. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. And I think that's a huge word there. We tried to be sensible. It's so easy to get off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. Thank you, Sigmund Freud. He did that for us. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow a man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a stray pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. And there's going to be a lot of different things. There's going to be people who have, you know, religious beliefs. There's all kinds of things that are going to go around sex. And I had a lot of that. I had a lot of religious beliefs around sex. We do not want to be the arbitrary of anyone's sex conduct. Now, one of the things that we all have sex problems. Let me finish that sentence. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? And I think that's the question. And one of the things, I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't have a huge sex inventory. It's really, and I was 18 years old. I know that this doesn't seem possible, but I lived in an era before birth control pills. I know that some of you haven't a clue about any of that. But I lived in an era before that, and if you had sex, sex came pregnancy, and that was the last thing that anybody wanted to have. So when I got married, I was a virgin. Now, I'm not saying I didn't do a lot of heavy petting and all the other stuff, and I think that's sex. And penetration doesn't always constitute sex, you know. I mean, it's all sex. But what happened was, is I felt that I was kind of not in that era, you know. That wasn't my thing. And besides that, towards the end of my drinking, I was so drunk and passed out, I didn't think about sex. And I was married to a military man. And so I thought I was so virtuous. Well, what happens is this sex inventory is about the people I've harmed. Who have I harmed? And I couldn't see how I had harmed my husband. I mean, you know, he went off to war. He was gone most of my marriage. When he got home, I was an obedient wife. And it was pointed out to me that my attitude was really harmful. And I used sex to get what I wanted. He wasn't there very often, so it was really easy to do. You know, you can really, manipulation, I mean, women learn it from the cradle and how to manipulate and get things they want. And I just thought I was so innocent. I mean, I don't do that. And, you know, I had a sponsor who had not the least bit of problem hurting my feelings. He wanted me to get better. And he pointed out, because he was military, he knew. He might have been a priest, but he knew. And so I had to see the things I had done to harm my husband and write those down. And then I had to ask myself, we reviewed our conduct over the years. Where had we been selfish? You know, I don't know about any of you, but a lot of times I could have a headache and be very selfish. Maybe he was interested in sex, but I didn't want to give sex unless I was interested in sex. And I've been told that men are always interested in sex, at least all the ones I've ever been around are. So, you know, and that somehow or another that I could withhold that and selfishly get what I want. Dishonest. But any of you been dishonest about how you react to the sexual act sometime? Women can do that, you know. Guys can't do that. Women can do that, can be really dishonest. It's wonderful to let them know how good they are and you can get everything you want. Fabulous. Inconsiderate. Did I ever take into account how that might make him feel? How inconsiderate playing little girl. My husband calls them girl games. Playing little girl games. Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? I don't know that I did that in my early inventory. where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? And one of the things that I think about really often is how my husband, my first husband, how he was a military man, he dedicated his life to the military, he was faithful, he was a provider, he was all these things. And I could have been considerate of who and what he was. But all I did was complain about how much he was gone, how much he wasn't there, how difficult the kids were to take care of. I never considered what he was going through and how I had harmed him. Yet on my resentment list, I mean, he had left me alone. He liked his job better than he liked me. He was more dedicated. I mean, all that selfish, self-centered stuff. But when I got here, I could see how inconsiderate I had been to a man who was dedicated to being a patriot, a good husband, and a good father, to the best he could be, given the time he was home. Because that's what he did. He was in the military, and I was inconsiderate. We got this all down on paper and looked at it. Now, in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sane ideal for our future sex life. We subjected every relationship to this test. Was it selfish or not? Now, my first inventory, I just didn't have a lot of inventory on that because I had this one person. Pretty much that was it. But what happened was, is this, you know, when it comes to inventory, it's not the only one we'll ever take. There are lots. And all the damage that I have done to myself and others, I did in sobriety. And one of the things that I've been thinking about long and hard about, and I've never even put this on tape, and I've done this at women's conferences and stuff, but one of the things that happened is when I got sober, and I'm not telling it yet, this is the old stuff. When I got sober, I don't know what happened, but my husband was ill. He was medically retired, 100% medically retired from the military. He had congestive heart failure. He had spent a lot of time in Vietnam and in Guam. And God knows what happened, you know, or what he picked up or what was going on. But he was really sick. And so I get sober. Now, I mean, it doesn't really matter that he's not doing much and he's ill when I'm drinking. But I get sober. And what happens for me is my libido kicks in. And all of a sudden, I want people to love me. As long as I'm drinking, I don't really notice. But now I want people to love me. And I feel like if you'll just love me enough, then I'll be okay. And I had to hit a bottom in sobriety behind relationships and sex that was so devastating that what happened for me is I ended up sober, becoming a slut in AA. And that nearly drove me to drinking. If anything was going to take me down, that was going to take me down. And today, when we read the preamble in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it says that this is a program of attraction, it is so important to me. It is so important to me that I behave as a sober, married woman. It is important that I do that because I used to not behave like that. And what I had done to my husband and my children, because my children knew about it, to the people I sponsored, how I had harmed them because of my sexual conduct. What happens if your sponsor's running around having, you know, affairs all over Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, if your sponsor's doing it, I guess I can do it too. It's definitely not the example that this book is asking us to see. This is a spiritual program, and my conduct was not spiritual. I harmed many women who walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that brought their husbands to AA. And I was running up to them in little cut-off tops and cut-off shorts and two Daisy May ponytails, running up, you know, "Welcome to AA. You look like what I want." You know, it was like, how many people had I harmed in doing that? And my children, because my children caught me out several times with different men. The other thing is at 38 years old, sober, 2 years sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I sit in an abortion clinic having an abortion with teenagers, sober in AA. And that's a part I've never put on tape. What did I do? What kind of harm did I do to that unborn child? I mean, it goes on and on when we do this. And it's all about selfish, self-seeking behavior. And why did I have that abortion? I'm 38 years old. I don't want to be bothered. It's all about me. It's all about selfish, self-centered behavior. Making amends. I've made amends. I've made amends to my sons. I've made amends to my ex-husband. And let me tell you the real miracle of it all is I'm married to Dave, and there's a lot of you who know Dave. And Dave and I were friends in Alcoholics Anonymous for 3 years, good friends. And Dave was my AA friend, and that was all. But the other thing is that Dave sponsored a lot of men that I had affairs with in AA. Dave knew more about me than he needed to know. And Dave and I often say to each other, if we'd have known we were going to get married, we never told each other the things we told each other. And what happened was, is when I was 3.5 years sober, Dave came up to me and he said, "Polly, I need to tell you this." He said, "I'm in love with you." And he says, "But you need to get something straight. I'm not going to have an affair with you. I want to marry you. And if you can't meet those conditions, then I understand." Now, see, something like that's not supposed to happen to women like me. And we were talking earlier about being in prison and how you get to have, you know, go to prison, and now you get to, you know, work in prisons and carry the message to prison, and you get to come full circle. Well, I was a prisoner, and I put myself in that prison in sobriety that I did not feel like, under any circumstances, did I ever deserve to have a marriage. I had mistreated the husband I'd had, and he was a good man. It would be easy for me to stand up here and tell you that he was not a good man, and that he had abused me and beat me and all those things, but he didn't do that. He just loved me. And when I got sober, he loved me and did everything he could to learn about the disease of alcoholism. He loved me. But see, I felt so bad about myself that I destroyed myself sober and hurt a lot of people in the wake of that because of a disease called alcoholism. And today, I've been able to come full circle. I am a woman today, as we stand here, that has been married to one man for 27 years. Dave and I have been married 27 years. And I want you to know something else that's fabulous, is I adore him, and I love him, and he's my hero, and he's still one of the, I often say Frank Honeycutt's the finest man I've ever known, and I tell Dave, he's one of the finest men I've ever known. You're the finest man I've ever known. But Dave loved me when I was unlovable. He saw past that, and he loved me. And it's been, and we've walked a lot of things together, and I am so grateful that I have been able to be honest and to live my life out loud and let you know, just because we get sober and we come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that it's not a license to be abusive sexually in these rooms. And somehow or another, I talked about this last week at I did this Fear and Sex at a step study in Cocoa Beach, and this lady came up to me and she said, you know, and this happens a lot of time, and it usually happens with women who have been abused, and this lady walked up to me and she says, well, you know, I think you calling yourself a slut in AA is not right. She said, there's a lot of perpetrators in AA, and I think you were a newcomer, and I think you just got involved with a lot of perpetrators. And I just kind of, you know, looked at her and I said, sweetheart, I was 36 years old when I got here. I definitely knew right from wrong. And I guarantee you, to be the kind of alcoholic I was and what I did, I was no saint when I walked in here. Believe me, I was just as much a perpetrator as they were. Because what I wanted is I wanted to feel better at somebody else's expense. And in doing that, what had I done? It says, whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy? How do you think my husband felt? Suspicion? I wonder where he thought I was so late at night off through all those AA meetings. Bitterness? Here he had been faithful to me all through this time. Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? And then the last column is, I like to say, what should I have done instead? One of the things that might have been super is I might have just talked to somebody before I acted. You ever sponsor somebody and they call and tell you what they've done? We ask God, when it talks about what we want to do is we want to form a sexual ideal of our relationship. Said in a few paragraphs earlier, it says, we remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be dispensed or loathed. Whatever our idea turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. And I had an idea. And I worked with my sponsor when Dave and I decided that we were going to get married, and this is what I'm Dave's fourth wife. So I can assure you, Dave wasn't a very good boy either. And so here you are, the sickest of the sick, which, you know, we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's 4 years sober and I'm 3 years sober. I mean, we're not even sober enough to know what we're doing. The only thing is I've been brought up on this book. I've been brought up in this book. And Frank says, you lay down what you want for what your idea is of a good sexual. What do you want in your sex life? What do you want for your sex relation? What is it that you want? And the very first thing I said was, I want to be faithful. I want to be faithful. I didn't know if I could. But I was told if I did this inventory, that, and I was willing, that God would do the rest. All I had to do was believe that God would help me in my sexual relations as much as he'd help me in my other relations. I wanted to stay married for a long time. I hoped that Dave and I would have a long life together. I wanted to have honesty in my relationship. And I think one of the things that happens is we get in relationships and then sex is such a sticky issue. And it's, what are the two hardest things to talk about in any relationship? Money. Sex and money. You got it. You got it. And I wanted to have the willingness and the courage to be honest. We must be willing to make amends when we have done harm. And on this sex inventory, I also put down harms done. And one of the people on that sex inventory was that child that I aborted because of selfish, self-seeking reasons. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. Be willing to talk about it. Let's talk about it. Because one of the things is when we can start to talk about it, we can start to have a sense of intimacy. And what is intimacy? In to me, see. For me to be willing to be honest with you and tell you the truth. And Dave and I, it's hard. When you start talking about these kind of issues, it's hard. But honesty. A lot of what went wrong with my first marriage was no one was willing to be honest and talk about it. It was like, if you don't talk about it, it'll go away. And what happens to things? It never goes away. It never goes away. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. Now, that was new, to sit down and start meditating and talking to God about these things. What can I do so that I don't do this behavior again? What actions can I take to be a faithful, good wife? And I start asking God to direct my actions and my thinking in my sex life, not just in my work life and in my relationships with other people, but in my sex life. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable. Talk to somebody. Talk to your sponsor. Talk to somebody. Even though these are difficult things to talk about, talk to somebody about it. And I've had women come to me and talk about some really bizarre things that have gone on in their lives. And I really found out I'm really not very versed in this. I don't even know why I'm talking about it because I don't know enough. But some really bizarre things. We talk about it, we write about it, and we inventory it. And then I say, well, have you thought about talking to your husband about this? Oh, I couldn't talk to him about it. Well, he's the person who needs to be talked about too with. That's where it needs to start. And when we begin to talk about things, we begin to work things out, and then resentments don't build, and we leave marriages because the resentment was there, and we never did anything to work on it and to find out if that could be solved. And one of the things that I have found in any relationship, if I bring God into what the problem is, any relationship in my life, and it's worked with the women I sponsor, if I bring God into that relationship and we pray and we ask God's help, most of the time we can find out what we need to do and that relationship is salvaged. Whereas had that action not be taken, that relationship would have been discarded. And I can tell you that today as I stand here. If I had known at 3 years of sobriety, married to my first husband, what I know today, I would still be married to my first husband. I don't know that that's what I know of today. I don't feel like that's what God had in mind. But I know that that could have been worked out if I had taken the same actions in my first marriage that I've taken in this marriage. And I believe that God has a plan, and he remarried, and I remarried, and he died 8 years ago. And our relationship was so good. I loved listening to Bob talk about his. Our relationship was so good that I have a child, and his family lives in Southern California about 10 minutes from us. And every time his widow would come visit my son and daughter-in-law and grandchildren, that had been healed so much that she stayed with Dave and I. In our house. And that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what we get to do here. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does that mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and we will have learned our lesson. And I truly believe that that's what happened to me, because I believe I could have gotten drunk. Doing what I did, I put myself in a very vulnerable place. But because of God, because of God, I have been taken to a better place. And I hope, learned my lesson. At least up until today, I've learned my lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. If I continue to use people for my own self-gratification, knowing what I know now, and continue to do that with them, you know, a lot of times Chuck C. used to say, if we knew better, we'd do better. Well, you know what? I know better. I know better. And if I continue to hurt people, there's no way I'm going to stay sober. And I believe what this book says. I believe it. And I take that even farther than sexual acts. If I talk about you, if I gossip about you, if I judge you, if I do all those things, that's harming you. And especially, and Bob's right, when I go gossiping about somebody to somebody else, I'm not gossiping to be kind and with their, you know, with them at, you know, in my heart, to, because I'm thinking about them. I'm talking about them so you'll like me better than you like them. That's all I'm doing, is trying to make myself look better and put them down. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. And this is the part that I love. And this is what I'm always getting calls from the women I sponsor. And it might be from a boyfriend, from a fiance, from a husband. And we're all, you know, whatever. He doesn't pay any attention to me, keeps rolling over in the night, all of this stuff, you know, whatever. And it says, if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves harder into helping others. So if this is a problem for you, I was told, if it's a problem for me, get busy. Get out there and find somebody to help. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge, when to yield would mean heartache. And I don't know about anybody else in this room, but I don't want that heartache anymore. I don't want that kind of heartache anymore. I don't want to try to take enough showers to make myself feel okay anymore. I just don't want that kind of heartache. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see the trouble, destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did to us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. And I love that. It's just a beginning. It's just a good beginning. And the second time I did this inventory was a lot different than the first time. I had just made a beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Okay.
Come back in 10 minutes.